C7. Number 11A.
Yes, this is a very important chapter. It's the last chapter Mrs. Eddy wrote for the textbook in 1891. And it is as if she would have given here really the pith of her discovery through those three parts in the chapter: science, theology, medicine. The scriptural note that she has here are indicative for what happens in the Christ, as the Christ. Come now to the chapter, Christ as the Christ. Christ in its own office, which is actually translation and retranslation. Translation naturally has to do with the level of absolute Christian science, and retranslation with the level of Christian science. And so we must see what is the authority from which the Christ takes the ability to translate and to retranslate. Therefore, our thought should now go up to the point of divine science, to the level of oneness, and investigate what kind of oneness is stated, from which then the translation and retranslation can take place. Let's just see if through the text we find indication of that high level of oneness. Let's just take first the scriptural note, the first one, which says, "But I certify you, brethren, that the gospel which was preached of me is not after men." So the gospel preached is not of me, not of men, therefore indicating it must be a gospel preached by God, putting it right back to God. "For I neither received it of men, neither was I taught it, but by the revelation of Jesus Christ." That's what Paul said. So he began to see that what has been revealed to him, that's the translation from God to man, has come from a higher source than man. Must have come from God. Mrs. Eddy says in the text, then, "My doctrine is not mine, but his that sent me." It's his, God's, that sent Jesus Christ. So can you see she tries to bring back her whole teaching to the source? She says, "No human pen nor tongue taught me the science contained in this book, Science and Health, and neither tongue nor pen can overthrow it." Again, indicating that the revelation came from such an authority that cannot be overthrown by men. So she asked herself in her own language, "Well, where did I get the revelation?" Paul said, "I got the revelation by Jesus Christ," and he got it by Jesus Christ when he was no more here, as you know, on the way of Damascus. He was no more, so to say, on earth. He was, so to say, in heaven. Therefore, giving a sense that he got his revelation from divine science. Mrs. Eddy, too, asked the same question as Paul was asking. She said, first, very nicely, "God had been graciously preparing me during many years for the reception of this final revelation of the absolute divine principle of scientific mental healing." So she says, first, "I have been prepared." I was not unprepared for the revelation. That's quite interesting for us to know. Because very often one has a feeling that students of any religion or of Christian Science feel revelation is something that comes from God right out of the blue. And therefore, I wonder, am I the one who will receive a revelation, or will I not be the one who will receive a revelation? It would be quite a good luck if I would get it, but if I don't get it, well, that's not my luck. I can't do anything against it, because revelation just comes from God to somebody, and that is the Blessed One. But Mrs. Eddy hasn't had that feeling. She said, revelation apparently only comes to those who have been graciously preparing themselves for the revelation. And this is most interesting to see, and is most interesting to see today. Because today we are facing in the world that very big question. You know that there are now so many mental, psychical, spiritual, religious groups. This is now in, which feels we need an expansion of consciousness, and most feel that expansion of consciousness just can come in a split second, right out of the cloud, right from heaven, and I will get it. And I will have my peak experience, whatever they call it, my great enlightenment. And so they still feel it is some kind of an act of chance that happens. That's one question. The other question of today is a similar one in the exact sciences. In the exact sciences up to about the middle of this century or even later, one was thinking that only through rational thinking, along a rational way, climbing up step by step, along the rational way of logic, we would arrive at a new insight and suddenly make a new discovery. And only in recent years, so around about 1950 onward, one began to realize, even in the scientific field, that intuition was a way of enlightenment. That is very important. That actually they felt, according to an investigation, that more than 80% of the big scientists who have made a big discovery feel that intuition was playing the major part in their discovery, that it actually came by intuition. And so the wrong conclusion then was that we should have intuition, and that intuition will give us a new insight and make a new discovery. And that naturally is not true, because all those people who had or made the discovery that came at the point of discovery through the way of intuition were graciously prepared in their field. They knew something about their field. It wasn't so that some psychiatrist suddenly had out of the blue a new insight into physics. It's only those who have been trained in the physical field and had graciously preparing their thoughts in a very ordered and rational and logical way in the science of physics that they somehow were able to receive through intuition a new model of thought, a new vision, a new approach to a subject. So it isn't so that we just can now sit back and say we don't have to culture our consciousness, because it's anyway all revelation. It's anyway all just intuition. All I need is an intuition. And then we know how how the women come along and say, well, you know, we women, we naturally work much more with intuition than with reason. We don't like reason, we don't like logic, we do it all through intuition. See, those two must go hand in hand. Real intuition, an intuition that does not come just from the subconscious, and brings up some old stuff of mortal mind and brings it up from the collective unconscious, or the individual unconscious, just brings it up to the surface as something new, is not a revelation. It's just a spitting out of the unconscious that is now seen. What is necessary is really how she presents here her discovery, that it was that wonderful balance of being graciously prepared a whole life long, being graciously prepared, over 40 years being prepared in a certain line, in the direct line, with the right question. She was the one who was asking the right question all along her life. All along her life she was asking the right question, which nobody was asking. She was asking that question, shouldn't Christianity and science be wedded? She was asking that question, shouldn't religion be a science? Isn't there a science behind spiritual things? Isn't all a mental phenomenon, not a material phenomenon? This, put back into her time, was really unique, you know. That wasn't common question. That was extraordinary question. She was already somehow in the line of extraordinary science that left the old landmarks of thinking and the old model of thinking. Christianity separate from science, religion separate from science. Only matter is real. It was the materialistic century. Matter is real. The spiritual is just subject to matter. Things like that. She was breaking new ground with questions in the right direction. She was asking the new questions. She was asking the question of the new paradigm. And therefore, she was graciously prepared for the breaking in of a new paradigm. It came in through inspiration, through revelation. It did not come in through reasoning out step by step until she got it. But the preparation of her consciousness was so that something new could break in and make sense. Because we know that revelation goes on all the time. That revelation which came to Mrs. Eddy went on all the time, since eternity, because God wasn't something else before 1866. He was always the same. But when a thought was ready to be transparent for an idea, then that idea could translate itself into human language, into human understanding, and make sense there. That revelation of that God can heal somebody from an incurable disease was a phenomenon that happened by the tens of thousands before Mrs. Eddy. The history of religion and of the saints is so big that there are thousands of these incidents of a marvelous healing, of miracles. These are not new. Miracles were not new. Mrs. Eddy wasn't the first to experience a divine miracle. She was the first one, when it happened, to ask the decisive question. Whereas up to that point, they never ask any more a question. They just say, thank you, dear God Almighty, I'm going to devote my life to you. I'm going into a monastery. Finished. Huh? Shut myself up. But she was asking a new question, the right question. He said, if that happens with me once, then there must be a law behind it. And if I find the law, then that can happen all over the time. Then it does not only happen here and there, but then we can make it happen. The moment I discover the law of gravitation, I can build an experiment so that the law of gravitation must happen. See, that's the difference. The law of gravitation always happens, but I can make it happen. And so that was, Mrs. Eddy could see, that she saw the ancient worthies, they had wonderful healings and they did miracles. But they didn't ask why. They didn't discover and investigate the law of it, the signs of it. Can you see what she is saying here? That we can't rely on intuition and say, well, I'm an intuitive person, you know, character. I do everything through intuition. I don't have to study. I don't have to know. I don't have to understand. My intuition tells me this and this and this. Oh, okay. But I have never seen somebody doing something big with it. But that wedding, that coupling, you know, of scientific training in the rudimentals, in the fundamentals, that enables us to make use of intuition and react on an intuition when that intuition comes and follow it up in the right way and therefore make something out of it. So here she was saying, I was graciously prepared over many years. And therefore I see this, that if we too are graciously going through the stereotyped laws, whatever there is stereotyped through what is mind and the ideas of mind, stereotyped through spirit and what is spirit, stereotyped through soul and what is soul, if you are going afterwards stereotyped through the idea, how does mind lead to spirit, how does spirit lead to soul, how does soul lead to principle, if we are in a stereotyped way, culture our categories. You see, when we do the stereotype thing, we are culturing the system. We are not culturing the application of the system yet. We are just culturing the system so that the system becomes our consciousness, the structure of our skull. We are culturing the skeleton of ourselves. Huh? Afterwards, we can build in the flesh too. So, only those, you can be quite sure, only those who culture that system through the categories are able to be transparent for suddenly a new influx of a new idea that begins to restructure that system and shows you a completely different model of approach. A different model of thought, but only those. The others just speculate on something. They too bring forth something new, but it's speculation, not the development of the scientific idea. It is not possible that through inspiration something new can be brought forward if it does not sound through the system. Because every new idea must be a higher sense, a more complex sense of the underlying system and not of something else. That was Mrs. Eddy tries here to show. Therefore she said, she asked then this nice question, whence came to me this heavenly conviction? After she had seen she was prepared, then whence came it? Just as soul suddenly could see that Jesus taught him something and he became Paul. Whence came to me this heavenly conviction, a conviction antagonistic to the testimony of the physical senses? It was the gift of grace of God given unto me. Can you see? It was a gift of grace. It was now no more a rationally thinking it out. It was now inspiration, revelation, the gift of grace given unto me by the effectual working of his power. Can you see the power sense? That he could see that revelation came from somewhere, higher up, from a higher source, the Christ in divine science. The power, his power that wanted to express itself. And that's the beautiful sense about Christian science, you see, that we know revelation is not just a partial gift that comes to one in a century, but that we can see revelation is something that comes from that source of divine science which says, I being, the one being, I have a power and I want to reveal myself. I do reveal myself. If then from beneath there is something that is graciously prepared for it, this is another question. If somebody is graciously prepared for it, he will hear the message. They will meet and they will hear it. She says, the revelation of truth in the understanding came to me gradually and apparently through divine power. Again, through divine power. And it came gradually. You know, again here you can see some kind of contradictory statement in Mrs. Eddy's writings. In one point she says that when she discovered Christian Science in 1866, it was a great influx of truth. And then she says it came to me gradually. Now these two statements do not contradict themselves if one considers them properly. What always happened is this, that just in a split second, when the time is ripe, a complete new aspect of something breaks in, or a complete new model of thought breaks in. But when it breaks in, it doesn't break in already right, finished to the last detail. It just comes first in into the great lines, just in a few great outlines. It comes in, but clear enough that it turns one's whole attitude into a new direction. But then, one usually has to work it out step by step, detail by detail, detail by detail, and it takes time, and it takes polishing one's consciousness, and discipline of consciousness, and so one can understand that she says it came gradually. And how gradually it came, we know, because it took Mrs. Eddy about how many years, 45 years, to write the textbook, so as I the way we have it now. It wasn't so that she had an influx and then she sat down and then she wrote the textbook and then that was finished and that was all a job of 3 months. No. It was a job of a lifetime. It was a job of a lifetime, the first half of a lifetime to prepare rightly and the second half of a lifetime to polish the revelation to the point that it was clear and clean and pure. What was actually that revelation? What does she say what that revelation was fundamentally when she goes right back to the origin without showing the details? She says it was Emmanuel. That was her revelation. God with us. Can you hear? Not man with God. God with us. God constantly manifesting itself as us, God with us. So she says, this apodictical principle points to the revelation of what? Of Emmanuel, God with us, the sovereign ever-presence. If you have the sovereign ever-presence, you have the tone of the level of divine science. So can you see, you also have to know a little bit the levels when you read this textbook in order to find out when does she speak about the oneness on the level of divine science, when on another level. So that was her revelation, actually fundamentally, from which she then could deduce the translation and the retranslation, that she would see God, the ever-presence, is God at the presence of God and as a presence of men. There is only one presence, and that presence is the presence of God and men. Where God is present, man is present. There is no duality there. Somewhere God is present and somewhere man is present. There's just one that ever presence, and therefore God with us. If you see that God is with us, if I read Emmanuel, what do I do as a scientist? I say Emmanuel is a biblical term. I can't do very much with a biblical term. I have to translate it into scientific abstract term. All right, it means God with us. This is still a biblical term. All right, what does it mean? What is God? Mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love. Therefore, what does it mean? Mind with me. Spirit with me. Soul with me. Principle with me. You know, I go through these simple statements like this. And you know, it makes a difference. I tell you again, it makes a difference. It makes a terrific difference if you say, oh yes, what has been revealed to me is Emmanuel, wonderful Emmanuel. You know that Emmanuel was prophesied already in Isaiah. Now we have it. Wonderful. Now 2,500 years ago was prophesied. Here we have it. Emmanuel, God with us. Fine. Full stop. No, not full stop. Huh? Now you begin. And you begin, say, mind with me, spirit with me, soul with me, principle with me, life with me, truth with me, love with me. That's ever-presence. And I lean back and I shut my eyes or shut my books or I look out into the stars at night, out of the window into that star and say, golly, what does that mean, mind with me? What does that mean that the ever-presence of mind is the presence of me? You know? And perhaps you can hardly spell it out, but you begin to feel it. Slowly you begin to feel it. Your consciousness begins to feel it, even if you can't spell it out anymore. And it naturally destroys within us that false belief of God having a wonderful presence, and I am somewhere present, but they are not the same presence. That is now destroyed in that pondering. And then no more, any more, will come up that sense that I am not the presence of God, that I am not God presence. Mind presence. Spirit presence. Soul presence. Can you see that that destroys the sense to long for God? Because if I long for God, if I long for mind, I am certainly not present with mind. And mind is certainly then not present with me. Can you see what it does to one? Okay.